Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Lee Eastwood Show. The show that the intelligence agents who just, you know, they have to, as a matter of a course of their job, listen and monitor and that kind of thing. And we try to entertain them, as well as understand that, of course, you know, everybody's working for the weekend, and some people are working for the week and the end of humanity, i.e. the intelligence agent. Anyway, my very special guest, James Corbett, coming at us live, I believe, from Japan, still, where, surprisingly, he's not suffering horrific radiation sickness like a lot of people have been going. Surprisingly, the Gulf of Mexico didn't turn into a giant tsunami like some predicted. Surprisingly, the world hasn't ended 1,000 times in a row like has been predicted, and those people who made all those predictions backpedal and then say, but there's another crisis looming and we need to continue raising funds to fight it. I love this planet. It's just so good. But the one thing that I found very, very interesting with people who aren't charlatans, who indeed have what I would call credibility. Now, credibility isn't what people think it is. Credibility isn't I'm always right. Credibility is I will admit when I'm wrong. And I will look at evidence even if I disagree with the premise or the claim initially. Credibility is something that is sorely lacking in the alternative media, but rather concentrated at thecorbettreport.com. So, James Corbett, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. I hope I can live up to an introduction like that, and I feel severely underdressed for the occasion now.
Well, Freemasonry, the tie, and everything like that. Well, just to actually explain this to the audience, you know what a tie is, ladies and gentlemen? You know how it's wrapped around your throat and it's a cord, right? In the Freemasonic ritual initiation ceremonies, it's called a cable toe. They tie a rope around your neck and they lead you through a blindfolded into a room where they then remove the blindfold. Okay, it's symbolic of the umbilical cord about how we come out of our mother's darkness and into the light of the world. That's the symbolism behind it. Now, on top of that, it's a leash, right? Like a dog, which is why it's also around a collar, around your neck, and which is why you are not free, ladies and gentlemen. That's why you have cuffs around your wrists. All right? It's a vague, subtle symbolism that we're trying to portray here on the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, thank you for edifying us. I'm glad to say I don't have the leash or the cuffs, so I'm free. I'm free!
Yeah, only the collar remains.
Only the collar, yeah.
Yeah, the choke chain. I mean, but in either case, I am so sorry to do this to you, but I completely forgot the exact reason why we were having this interview. So I'm just going to quickly browse back to my... here we are. I just watched your video on the real Middle East threat, and I'd like to devote an hour of your time, but I assume not only mine, speaking about it. And I also wondered how you felt about Alex Jones and QAnon and the meteoric slide from allegedly being about truth to become about nothing more than trumpeteers. And what this says about the importance of audiences learning about media discernment. So that's the topic and breadth for today, ladies and gentlemen. So to start off, the real Middle East threat. Would you be able to encapsulate maybe your video just a little bit here?
Well, this is revolving around the recent dust-up regarding the Iranian nuclear deal, the JCPOA, which, of course, the United States has now withdrawn from. And this came out just as at the moment where they were making that announcement, because, of course, the big implication is, oh, this is a terrible deal and it's going to allow Iran to blah, blah, blah. And Iran, they're the big nuclear threat, which is ridiculous because, of course, the big 3 billion pound elephant in the room with regards to this conversation is that there already is a nuclear power in the Middle East. It has hundreds of nuclear weapons. It is ranked somewhere around the sixth largest nuclear stockpile of any nation on the planet, but we can't know for certain because this particular nuclear power is not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It has never had any of its stockpile inspected by anyone. It does not even admit that that nuclear stockpile exists formally, officially. And of course, that's not Iran, that's Israel. And that's the big excluded part of the conversation when it comes to nukes in the Middle East. They are already there. In fact, there is a country that has been arguing for decades that the Middle East should be a nuclear-free zone. That country is Iran. They first proposed that back in the 1970s, I want to say, maybe 1960s. I don't remember the timeline on that. Anyway, they have renewed that call for a nuclear-free Middle East over and over again throughout the decades. Even as late as last decade, they were calling for it again. But the United States and Israel didn't want that for some reason. I wonder why. Oh, that's because Israel has its undeclared nuclear stockpile. So that is, I think, the real nuclear threat in the Middle East. If we want to talk about nukes, well, they're already there, but they're not in the hands of the Iranians.
When I saw Trump visit Israel recently with a giant bus with a billboard on it saying, "Make Israel great again." Oh, God, the hurt in my brain places. What's the problem with having discernment, which a lot of audience members do not have? That's why I like my audience, because they're adults, they're mature, you know, they listen, they learn, they actually look at something before making a judgment on it. It's probably why they keep listening. But the other thing is, when we're looking at the situation with Trump and Iran, I am reminded of 1984 and this concept called newspeak, about managing the history, about finding something that you want to say the party did this, and then go, hey, let's eliminate everything else throughout history that has any evidence to the contrary, and we'll make people believe this thing, even though they know inherently that it's not true. It's called doublethink. And now I'm wondering if that phenomenon's actually starting up in the United States alternative media circuit as well. The concept of doublethink, which is, you know, the war on terrorism is a BS ploy by the New World Order to enslave you and the entire human race and bring about a phony wars and global government. And yet here you are saying, hey, we need to have wars on Muslims and global government. You know, it's I don't know how you feel about that, the slide of the alternative media during the Trump era.
Yeah, it's kind of sadly predictable, I think. How many of the people who were railing against the 9/11 false flag were genuinely on the side of truth when it came to these issues, and how many were just sick of kind of, you know, status quo politics as usual in the Republican Party or whatever. So now that they have a chance for somebody, some greater leader to come along and lead them, they're happy to go and follow that that person off the cliff like lemmings. And that's, unfortunately, that's exactly what's happening. And yep, the narrative has moved on, hasn't it? Since we so thoroughly debunked the Al-Qaeda myth and then the ISIS myth and everything that came along in the with regards to that. But now, once again, it's the turbaned boogeyman who is the boogeyman du jour. And, that's who we all have to be afraid of. Not the governments that are funding, perpetuating, arming, equipping, and mobilizing these terrorists. No, it's the boogeymen. It's the turban wearers that we have to be shaking in our boots about. So, as I say, it's kind of sadly predictable. I don't think it's a shock that this has happened. To me, at any rate, it's just
why would you say that it's predictable? I mean, you've seen it happen before with lots of shifts and that kind of thing.
Well, I think it's just the did you ever get the sense that it was, you know, 95% of people who were following the alt media were doing so for the pursuit of the bottom level truth? Or do you think that people are just going along with whatever's kind of, I don't want to say popular, but counterculture, what's seen as counterculture? So all it takes is to shift people's perception of what counterculture is. And at this point, well, I won't even mention names, but some people in the alt media have framed it now that conservative is the new punk. You know, this is the new thing that's cool and counterculture and is against what your parents believe, because we've now grown up with a good half century of the counterculture being the left and being against these right wing politicians and stuff. Well, now it's flipped, and now the establishment and the status quo is seen as being on the left. So now it's cool and counterculture to be conservative. And of course, everything that comes mixed and bunched in with that, including the old narratives about the clash of civilizations and all of this, taken at face value. So it doesn't really matter what's been exposed in the past. It's still the boogeyman can still be dangled out and still be used as an effective tool.
It's said in the book 1984, which the society that is depicted in it, only 30 years after the massive war that actually triggered their world government and everything like this, they'd completely rewritten history and nobody knew anything except what the party told them. And I'm thinking that we're so deadly close to that now, that it's our commentators that are telling us what actually happened throughout history and not the facts themselves.
Yes. Well, I mean, we are in the most mediated environment of any culture in the history of humanity. Almost all of the information that we take in about the outside world at this point is coming through media of some sort. And we are, and now it's a question of, well, which media voices do you listen to? So which sort of angle on reality are you taking on board? And I'm not sure there's a way around that at this point, other than just to ditch all technology and, you know, goodbye to conversations like this one, or most of the things that most of us, I think, probably take for granted at this point. So you can retreat into the cocoon of not being a Unabomber, I guess. Or if you engage with this, it is a question of choosing which sources that you're going to get your information from, and that's going to shape your worldview. And increasingly so. We know about the filter bubble and things that come along with it, and we're all guilty of it. You are, and I am, and everyone listening to this conversation, there's no way around it, because the only thing you can do is try to venture outside of your filter bubble from time to time, but it's all about habituation. And if you're in the habit of just going along with what's most comfortable for you and whatever you're used to hearing, then you're never, ever going to escape that bubble.
Now, what was also very interesting about that bubble is it was created by people who exposed not just previous presidents, but the entire presidency as a CFR, Trilateral Commission, Bilderberg Group run administration, regardless of which president gets in power. And then they promote the new president who gets in power, who puts Bilderberg Group attendees, Trilateral Commission members, high degree Freemasons, and so on and so forth into his cabinet. And doesn't say a word about it, right? And you think to yourself, okay, what's going on with the alternative media here? Is it cognitive bias, or is it like Cass Sunstein said back in the days when he said we need cognitive infiltration by the government of groups like 9/11 Truth? Has the government been successful in infiltrating, intimidating, and taking over a good portion of what appear to be genuine alternative media outlets? You know, but that's something I think maybe for another time. But the trumpeteering is it's just diabolical. You can see how people go from very similar to how Bill Hicks talked about Clinton versus Bush. He said, I didn't vote Bush. I voted Clinton. Clinton's a liar and I hate him, but he's not a mass murderer. Like that guy is, right? That kind of thing. Playing this card game about who's best, who's worst at the time. Now, if Hillary had become president, sure, it's bad. But what we've got now is somebody who's not actually, shall we say, part of the awareness of what government actually means. And what I mean by that is there's a way that things run in business that they do not run in politics. Okay, firstly, politics is specifically there to grind almost everything to a halt. You've got innovation, you've got changes that you want to make. Well, we've got committees, we've got hearings, we've got a huge rigmarole process to follow. And the reason for that process is to ensure that society changes slowly and gradually. But in business, on the other hand, you need to adapt to situations incredibly quickly, So you're used to getting things done on the fly. So when somebody like Trump, who's used to doing business, and by business I mean being part of the criminal Jewish mafia who gave him his first casino, which he bankrupted, that's his business his business acumen, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. But what I worry about is the patience, the impatience, and specifically the narcissism, right? Because I had this conversation the other day. I was like, if you're only, like we were talking about with media sources, if you're only listening to a narcissist, would you become more narcissistic? And what are the characteristics of that? Less empathetic, more overreactive, more involved with anger and rage when you're criticized and things like that. Trump's been up at 3 o'clock in the morning blocking people on Twitter, right? Clear narcissism in every single case. How is this affecting the audience? And what do you reckon the importance is of audience members learning discernment?
Well, here's the real important discernment to make with regards to this, which you've already touched on, is that the presidency is a figurehead position. It is just the thing that you look at that represents the power structure, but of course is not the power structure. The power structure is everything underneath and behind. It is the deep state. And so people are aware of this more so than before. But all you have to do then is create the narrative that, oh, don't worry, this guy is fighting the deep state. So everything that happens is happening for the reason that he is fighting the deep state. And everything that looks like it's going in favor of the deep state, or, you know, why did he appoint the CIA torturer to be the head of the CIA? Or why is he buddying up with John Bolton, you know, the biggest neocon warmonger of them all? Oh, it's 12-dimensional chess. I mean, of course. And it's keep your enemies closer. And there's all these kind of platitudes for absolutely any decision that's made. And every single thing that happens is kind of swept away under the rug. But if we're looking for sci-fi dystopian references to base things on, let's go to the much more probably up your alley sci-fi Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where the president of the galaxy was Zaphod Beeblebrox, who ran nothing, was a joke. It was just he was there for purely entertainment purposes, just to distract people and to make them. He ran nothing. He had no power. This is the Trump presidency. This is what we're going to see from now on, is more and more. This is the show. This is entertainment. But what is actually being run and by whom? It is not President Trump at 3 a.m. on Twitter who is running the country. This is the childish, you know, 7-year-old version of reality that people are more and more getting themselves invested in as part of their identity. And I would love if people stopped talking about the president, the president, the president, the president, the president, as if that was the most important thing in the world. It really isn't. And once we get out of that mindset, maybe we can start discovering some ways out of these scenarios. But it's not going to happen if we continue to look at the figurehead and talk about the figurehead and have our love or hate for the figurehead. Then we're misdirecting all of our energy.
Mm. If anything, that seems to be a deliberate ploy that gets used by the power structure of society to placate people, essentially, endlessly play them off against each other. That way they never try to cut off the hand that's really running things. This reminds me, though, of a conversation I had with a listener, and they said they were really, really into the Kilauea volcano stuff right now. Okay, right? So she's living in New Zealand. Okay, so I was like, okay, you want to know everything you can about that. Right, that's fine, there's no problem with interest, just curiosity. Does it affect you in any real way in your day-to-day life, some volcano that's going off very lightly 10,000 kilometers away? You go, no, but I'm very worried about it. By chance, are you worried about it because you keep looking at the situation?
But not many, only, what if it falls into the ocean and creates a 400-meter tidal wave tsunami and we all die?
I mean, that's what she said. And I said, well, let's say it does create a 400-meter tsunami and we all die. At what point would you, knowing about it beforehand, worrying about it for extensive periods of time and doing preparation for it, in any way help you from a 400-meter high tsunami? You go, oh, well, I live on a mountain near the coast, and I might be all right. It's just, you're missing the point. All right, and it's a microcosm of these little rabbit holes that we get ourselves dumped into. We pump ourselves up with adrenaline and fear, and we activate our reptilian cortex, and we abandon our higher thought, and we abandon our social responsibility through our mammalian brain. Therefore, we ain't doing any higher thinking, and we ain't doing any empathic thinking. Here's how you know if a media source is good for you, ladies and gentlemen. Listen to it. You hear that? You hear empowerment. Okay, this is a media source worth listening to. Listen to that. That smells like fear and disempowerment, something I can't do anything about. This is bad media that is not worth your time. Okay? That's called discernment, ladies and gentlemen. And that I think that's pretty freaking important if we don't want to be filling our heads with junk that is not only not important, principally, but specifically, it distracts us from our own lives and what we can do in the moment to affect the world. And with the internet, there's almost nothing that to stop you from affecting the entire world by making a video or doing a radio podcast or some shit. You know, Joe Rogan's up to like, what, episode 911 or something like that of his podcast. It's insane. People just love to hear people talk and have genuine conversations, don't they, James?
They do. And the empowerment part is an extremely important part of it, because the discernment comes at the level of what information are we going to take on board in the first place. It's not necessarily, you know, what are we going to do about the issue of this or that or the volcano or whatever. It's why are we directing our attention that way in the first place? And this is something that occurs to me in the wake of every big breaking news event in the United States. People will come to me, what do you think about this? And it's in the last several months, it's generally been the latest school shooting or whatever. And I find it so bizarre. I find it interesting that A, this is presumed to be the biggest event in the entire world at the moment. So everyone has to be talking about it. Some shooting in, I don't know, in the middle of nowhere in the United States. Okay, great. You're in America. It affects you personally. I get it. Well, you're coming to a guy, a Canadian in Japan, who has no conceivable relation to that. And no, it does not. That has nothing to do with my reality. But I'm going to be the one that you're going to turn to for what? Getting down to the bottom of what really happened in this or that shooting, as if this is the most... I mean, I get it in the heat of the moment and in that week when probably people are watching CNN or whatever or hearing it constantly in their day-to-day lives, so they think this is the thing that everybody in the world must be talking about. I at least get that, but it's weird to me when people come like months and months and months later and they're like, why aren't you talking about this? I'm like, oh, wait, is that still a thing? I thought it was just the 24-hour news cycle that they're trying to distract you with.
I thought it didn't matter then, just like it doesn't matter now, you know?
Well, this is the thing. I've been trying consciously to direct more of my attention towards the bigger kinds of issues than the 24-hour news cycle. That's because funny.
I was talking to my wife this morning about you, my wife has no familiarity with my work whatsoever. You know, hasn't listened to a show once in 10 years. you know, that's why she still loves me. But the thing I tried to explain to her, you know, like, who was James Corbett? How do you explain this to somebody who has no awareness of the truth movement? And I said, okay, well, you compare James Corbett to the news. The news tell you scary thing, inaccurate information, but they tell you it now. James Corbett tells you truthful thing, valuable thing, important thing, way long after whatever has transpired has already been transpired and investigated. So that way you get complete gnosis of a subject rather than just a stab in your reptilian cortex with fear.
I appreciate that. I would like to think that's mostly the case. I do cover news and things that are happening as well. But I do try to keep it in the bigger perspective because, look, I've been doing this for over a decade now. I can go back and look at things that I've done in the past. And there are things that I talked about, you know, 8 years ago that are as relevant today, maybe even more so than they were at the time when people were saying, why are you talking about this? So I know the value of this long term. But it's a question of getting people interested in things that are not they don't immediately sense of what is this? Why
they're
are
not
you telling
trending?
Us yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's exactly. And the technology is wiring us to become more and more fixated on the trending, the new, the this is what we're all discussing today. And it's weird because the big promise of internet and decentralized media was that we were going to escape and break out of all these gatekeeping things. Like, of course, back in the day when everybody read the same newspaper or everybody watched the same 6 o'clock news, of course, these are the things that everyone will be talking about. But now we have access to all this information from billions of people all around the world instantaneously. And now everyone's still talking about the same, you know, five or six news items that are trending. It's sad.
I was also wondering, is that concept of this 24-hour news cycle, the constant now, sort of thing, what kind of an effect is that having in general on the behavior and the mental development or mental devolution, if we're going to be too frank about it, of the audiences? I mean, like, let's say you're doing that kind of program and you're running this scam. What's it doing to your audience?
Well, it's programming people for a certain view of reality. And people, I mean, it's difficult even for yourself or myself, I'm sure, to remember that the 24/7 constant on news cycle is an exceptionally new concept in human history. It's been around for a few decades, basically. I mean, CNN started in what, the 19, I want to say early 80s? From that point on, yeah, I guess the idea of a 24/7 constant news feed has been a thing. But even then, I mean, really, in terms of the type of 24/7 constant scrolling news feeds that we have now with Twitter and Facebook and all of this, that's an exceptionally new phenomenon. And before that, what did people do? What did people do 100 years ago for news? News was a different concept because, of course, it had to be taken and analyzed and collected and then written about and then delivered to you physically somehow, and then you would take it and digest it. So the idea of this is the thing that's going to be making headlines today, that wasn't even possible. And I'm not saying that's necessarily better or that we should somehow scrap all this technology, but I'm just saying it is rewiring us to see reality in a different way. And it is causing people, I think, to lose sight of larger picture issues because we can now hone in on fine-grained detail to such an incredible extent. It makes me think of larger philosophical issues about, you know, now that we can subdivide hours into minutes and then minutes into seconds and then seconds into microseconds, our concept of time itself starts to change, and who we are as beings in this world starts to change from a perception you would have had hundreds of years ago when all you had is the sundial and you kind of have an idea, oh, it's kind of, you know, around the mid-morning or now it's afternoon kind of thing. But that was the level of granular detail people had about their lives at that point. It starts to shape and change the way that we run our lives. Well, now we, you know, we have digital alarms so we can wake up at 6:37 a.m. so that we can catch the 6:52 train so that we can get to the station at 7:12 so that we can get to work at, you know, 7:15 on the dot and blah, blah, blah. And it starts to regiment our lives in ways that would not have been possible before. Similarly, when we have 24/7 news feeds and cycles and this type of thing, we can start to direct our lives in a way that becomes the most important thing. And we start to lose touch of that silent contemplative part of ourselves that used to exist. I go back even a decade ago and think, I didn't have these slave device in my hand at all times. I wasn't constantly listening to podcasts. I wasn't, you know, checking news feeds and things every 5 minutes. I was sitting there reading a book for hours at a time and, you know, thinking about what I'm reading and maybe writing something by hand in a journal. I don't do any of that anymore. This technology is structuring my life in a way that is occluding those types of experiences. And so where is my time for self-reflection, to be alone with my own thoughts? That's slowly disappearing. And we are becoming this Borg-like entity. Again, I'm not sure I have the solution to that, given the world that we're living in, but it is an important part of humanity that we're starting to lose.
Well, I saw an interesting video this morning, and I was just like, oh, I didn't expect to see that happen. PJW saying That's Paul Joseph Watson to you, ladies and gentlemen. The Paul Justice Warrior. Anyway, he'd really hate to be called that, wouldn't he? He'd actually. Anyway, a great video about Facebook and social media, and essentially what it's doing is precisely as you said, James. It's programming our minds, and this was actually done intentionally by the designers of Facebook to suck your attention, to addict you to it by giving you little dopamine rushes. Every time you get a little like, every time you get a little vibrate in your hand in your pocket that says that there's a text message coming or something like that. These are all little dopamine rushes. Now, that's the same rush that you get from smoking a cigarette, from gambling, from drinking, you know, that kind of thing. So essentially, it's an addictive behavior. Now, what it does is you also actually raised this point, James, I want to address it. You were talking about concentration inherently. You had time to sit down and concentrate on something. Now, what's happened recently is overall the period of concentration that somebody can really put out there as a child is like nothing. But now the period of concentration that people can put out there as an adult is still nothing. Like, that's what social media has actually done to us. It's completely rewired our brain. Now, this is inherently dangerous because the most productive people in the world, the most efficient people in the world, and the smartest people in the world do one thing a hell of a lot more than the average social media user. They concentrate on something for a period of time, and then they take a break from it, and then they go back to concentrating on it. They're not surfing the web. They're not sitting around waiting for things to influence them. They have intentions. They go out there. They fulfill them. All right? And we are being robbed of that motivation because of the social media. Now, it's an interesting thing, and the reason why I bring up Paul Joseph Watson saying this is that he said that, yes, I too am suffering from this Facebook addiction. We all are. If you're watching this video right now, if you're hearing this right now, you are too. We're all suffering a form of addiction to this. And it was kind of important to really admit that to ourselves, because the first stage of the grief process is denial. And if you're still in denial, baby, you've got to wake up to that fact and start getting angry about it. Be angry at yourself. I've let myself slip into this. I've let Zuckerberg and the CIA financiers, and by the way, that's admitted and documented fact that CIA seed companies actually flooded Mark Zuckerberg with Facebook so they could use it to surveil people. That kind of thing is having an effect on us, and we actually have to change what we're doing. Now, what PJW said is basically check your Facebook, if you have to do it, you know, for your work and everything like that, check it 5 times a day tops. And I was like, whoa. That's like a 90% downgrade for most people, isn't it? You'd be checking it hundreds of times a day every time you check out your phone. You know? Whoa. So we're getting to the point now that where not only there's this ignorance and this lack of attention span, but there's also this consciousness rising to oppose it, right? And people are starting to kind of open up and go, there is something wrong with me, and only I can do something about it. Quite positive, I think.
That's hopeful. I hope you're right. People who want, perhaps, I hope, a more in-depth exploration of that can turn to episode 332 of The Corbett Report, The Weaponization of Social Media, where I talked about exactly that, how social media was consciously intended and designed to program you and to exploit your psychological vulnerabilities and your neurochemical vulnerabilities. So I had Sean Parker's comments about how basically this, yeah, we knew we were hacking your mind when we started creating this, basically. I also go into the fact that social media is and has been a kind of playground, an experimental playground for DARPA and other government-funded researchers to find out more about you and how you tick and how they can manipulate your behavior. Because let's never forget that Edward Bernays, the man who literally wrote the book on propaganda 100 years ago, as relevant today as it was then, perhaps more so, said that it was the manipulation of the conscious intentions and habits of society by unseen people that constitutes the true ruling power of our society. And he was so right about that. It is about manipulating your habits more so than anything else. If they can get your habits and opinions, then they have you. If they can just get you habituated into doing certain things at certain times of day, just thinking that, you know, in order to get informed about the world, I just flip on my slave device and look at the newsfeed and I'm up to date. If they can get you into that habit, then you can be programmed in all sorts of ways that you never even think about. So that's an important part of it. And yes, myself, I found myself with Twitter. I was never on Facebook, thankfully, but I was on Twitter. I did get on in 2011 because I'm like, oh, you know, I'm late to the party, but I should promote my work on Twitter. So I got onto it. And by earlier this year, I was literally at the park with my children, playing with my kids, and finding myself, oh, I'll just flip out my phone and check my Twitter feed. And I had to stop myself and think, what am I doing? What on earth am I doing? This was meant to be just a way for me to, you know, get the word out about my work. And now I'm so addicted to it that I'm taking time out of playing with my children to do this. So I had to step away. So I scrapped Twitter. I'm no longer on Twitter. And I'm looking for more ways to do that, to try to regain some of that mental space that I know I used to have just a few short years ago that wasn't filled up with all this junk. Where did that go? So it is a question of having to physically stop yourself sometimes and look at your actions from a third person perspective and go, this is not normal. Let us not normalize it, because normalization is really the key to all of this. And if we don't step out from that sort of outside perspective and look at what we're doing from time to time, we're just going to start falling into the wrong habits.
What's the likelihood that a society that has known nothing but addiction and habits from birth, what's the likelihood that that society will ever revolt against their masters?
Yeah, I think you just answered your... I think that question answers itself. And that's the real problem in all of this, because it's always the intergenerational factor in this. I can't know what it was like to grow up in my parents' era, but my things that my parents used to, my dad resisted having a debit card for the longest time, and I used to make fun of him for that. Or he resisted having a cell phone. I used to think, oh, you know, you old fuddy-duddy. And now, from my perspective, I can see, oh, okay, I kind of get it, because there are all these things coming down the pipe now that I know I'm going to reject, but I don't know about my son. I don't know about my daughter. They're going to see it as completely normal, and they're going to see me as the weirdo for not wanting to go along with these types of new technologies. And that's how they get you. It's just a question of the next generation goes a little bit further and a little bit further and a little bit further. And that's how Fabian socialism worked. That's how a lot of things happen to completely change society.
Yeah, that's how the invasion of the body snatchers works. You know, they get you while you're what? Sleeping. Ah, isn't that interesting? And I just realized that. how are we implanting images into people's minds and things like that? But there's the other side of it as well, because I've had these moments in my life, and I'm sure you've had them too. All people who have some kind of purpose to their life have had these moments where you will talk to somebody who you respect, and they will tell you something that you were completely unaware of. Like, you had no idea about this thing. And this is somebody you've known for a long time. And it's not necessarily something about them. It's just something that they think about the world. And you're taken aback by it for a second. You go, You start to question your own reality. I think that's what is going to happen when people are waking up, essentially. Now, when I say waking up, people don't take that analogy any further. Oh, I've woken up. Like, really? That's it. You don't need to go have a piss. You don't need to find your slippers. You don't need to turn your annoying alarm off. You don't need to have a coffee. You don't need breakfast. You don't need fuel. You don't need nutrition. You don't need to take a lunch break. You ain't got no job to go out and fight, you know? That kind of thing. People think that waking up, that all is not as it seems, is enough. It's not frickin' enough. It's waking up to yourself. That's enough. Oh, I've got this power and potential, and I'm not squandering it. You're now awake. You know, that's, I think it's sort of a pass-fail test. But I also wondered, are we reaching sort of a moment of crisis in the alternative media industry, which is going to provoke infighting amongst the audience, okay? This, as David Icke would say, the slaves fighting the slaves for the slave masters, right? And I that prospect really terrifies me, of watching the overwhelmingly good people within the alternative media at each other's throats and getting nowhere, while meanwhile really bad stuff is being set up, not even in the background, but right in front of them. They're too busy fighting with each other to even look up. Ah, they're putting up double barbed wire fences all around us, eh? No, I'm still going to argue. Yeah, it's those people that are to blame. Yeah, let's blame somebody. Let's not take responsibility. I mean, why would I want to do that? But in either case, yes.
Well, this is one of the insidious parts about this newsfeed phenomenon, is that it turns us into spectators, that our role is to consume information, and our basically our agency in that is to choose, oh, we will go with this outlet or that outlet, we will take this side or that side. But it's not to actually affect the world. It's only to take a side and kind of, you know, okay, here's my team and I'm going to, you know, be on this side and I'm going to consume this information, and that's my choice and that's my identity and that's who I am. Turning us into spectators means that ultimately you end up arguing about the people who are, you know, the spectacle, not only in the, you know, the president sense, so here's the spectacle president kind of thing, but also, you know, yeah, your media is this personality or that personality, and I like this guy, I don't like that guy. And it starts to become about here's the thing, the shadows on the wall, you know, the cave and all of that, we're just looking at the shadows. And people start arguing about the shadows themselves rather than even what the shadows represent, let alone reality. I mean, it's like two steps removed from reality. And so ultimately, this should always come back down to what can we actually do in our own lives to affect our own lived reality. That is the ground basis of reality for any human being that wants to function in the world. But we've been so extruded into this realm, this abstract digital realm, where we're fighting over avatars and things like this, that it's so beyond our actual lived experience that we almost forget that we can impact the world. And of course, that always comes down to what can we do in our own day-to-day lives to choose to give our time and energy and money and attention to this or to this, or to create something different here, or to interact with people in a different way there. Those are the things we can actually do, but it's always being kind of taken away from us, in the sense that we are just mindless robots to be spectators, to choose sides in imaginary tales that are going on in our heads mostly, rather than what we actually do in our day-to-day lives. And well, maturity, that's getting worse and worse.
Maturity comes from having real life experience. Recent statistic has come out that United States teenagers, on average, spend less time outdoors than United States inmates in the prison system. If you want to have a real life experience and grow up as a person, those people are actually, the numbers are shrinking by the day. Imagine that. We've now got augmented reality, virtual reality coming in. Watched a video with some of my band members the other day about 10 fabulous new holographic technologies that are coming out. You know, real holograms in front of you. You know, the future's not that far away, ladies and gentlemen. It's approaching and faster every day. And we're getting to the point now where being human will no longer be enough. And I think that's when the post-human era will start to begin. Implantable microchips that interface with your brain and so on and so forth. And to the point where people will be so far removed from having real life experience and so indoctrinated out of valuing it or even knowing what it is that there will come a time when nobody has had real life experience but the people who run society.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the point. Of course, as always, it's what, you know, don't do as I say, do as I tell you. And we are being fed all sorts of bread. It's not just bread and circuses. As you say, I mean, this is a different concept of reality that we're being fed, or virtual reality. And when that takes over and everyone is interacting with each other on that basis, then yeah, game over. I mean, what is even left of humanity at that point? When it's all virtual experience and all just avatars interacting with avatars in a cyberspace, you know, end of humanity.
Isn't that where Huxley said that the... Oh, in fact, there was another point in the PJW video about the rise of neo-Ludditism. Now, for those who don't know what a Luddite is, back in the day when they started creating, you know, mechanical looms and things like that for weaving, and they were putting a whole bunch of people out of work in the early industrial era, these people called Luddites came out and said that the development of technology was destroying society and costing them their jobs and so on and so forth. And there's a big resurgence in that idea. Now, one might say, oh, they're just throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But I say, well, maybe they've got a point. I don't fully agree with the point. However, there are very, very easily provable dangers to our technologies. Even the wireless microphone, Mac and keyboard and mouse that I see behind you there, James, that's 30,000 microwatts per device. Right, that you're going to be constantly bathed in when it's working, all three sources at once. Right, little things about EMF and EMR we're being bombarded constantly, and I think maybe part of the conspiracy scam, maybe that's a new terminology we need to start using, James, is the conspiracy scam, is that we're trying to get you involved in conspiracy not to help you with it or help you fight against it, but just to get your attention and to make you afraid so that you watch our next video, right? That's the conspiracy scam, ladies and gentlemen. Don't fall for it.
Yeah. And that works on a number of levels. It's not just the creators of the conspiracy media that are obviously benefit from you getting hooked onto their material as if it, again, as if it's a spectacle and you're just a spectator and just keep clicking. That, of course, obviously the creators are incentivized that way. But from the broader societal perspective, the controllers benefit from that as well, because again, everyone cocooned in their habit of just being consumers of information rather than actual participants in society. So it kind of works. Yeah, we don't care if you're getting the truth, even an approximation of the truth, or even the truth itself, as long as you are just kind of consuming it. If you are just a consumer of this information and just trapped in your, you know, in the confines of your little open air prison, then go for it and just become, you know, jack yourself into the matrix. We're happy for that to happen. And I think that is part of the long-term plan of what's going on.
Yeah. It reminds me of that bit in the end of the Pearl Jam song video that was directed by Todd McFarlane, the guy, the creator of Spawn. And it's got this guy who's at a desk like a zombie, but then the desk comes alive with cables and stuff like that, and it grabs him and wraps him and shoves itself up his nose and down his throat and in his ears and into his brain and everything like that, and just enslaves him and hooks him to the screen, you know? And that's happening in frickin' slow motion. Like, we're slowly becoming mechanized, aren't we?
Yeah.
Right?
Not even that slow, really. Mm. I mean, again, think of just the last decade of technology and how it's, you know, it's getting more and more into every personal space you have. And then when you're on the road, you've got, you know, got something with you at all times, some tablet, some screen. Mm. It's happening so quickly when you look at it from the kind of lifetime perspective that you don't notice it. It's like changes in the mirror. You don't notice them every day, but then you go back and look at a picture from 10 years ago and, oh yeah, I used to look like that. I mean, that's the way it's happening on a societal scale right now.
Okay. So finaling this up, I want to give people something actually practical that they can use in terms of their media discernment. So James Corbett, in your opinion, what are good media sources look like? What are their characteristics? And what do bad media characteristics? Like, what do you watch?
Well, that's the thing. I'm trying to think in terms of my own. So what are my own habits? And I like to think that I try not to get wedded to sources. Because I understand why it happens, and I think everyone
does
this
to a certain extent. That's the reason I asked the question the way I did, because it's not about pointing out that person's good, that person's good, because over the years, I've seen good people turn fucking bad.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. And even good, well-meaning people who are really good and do good research and whatever, they get stuff wrong as well. I mean, it's just things happen. So trusting in a source is the wrong way to think about it. I always try to bring it back to the information, which is why I always try to put all of the source documents and everything that I'm talking about. I try to link it so that you can, if you want, and I know most people don't, but if you want, you can go and you can follow the cookie crumbs and see how I constructed this picture and then decide for yourself, oh, well, but what about this and what about that? And oh, you didn't take into account that. To make it more interactive. That's, I think, the real promise of this new media, is that it was always designed for us to have a space to insert ourselves in this mix. We are not just passive recipients of information. We are actively constructing that information by taking the initiative to follow sources, to go and to look and to supplement and to take from this billions and billions and billions of pages of information that now exist at our fingertips, more information than has ever existed in the hands of any emperor or pharaoh or king or god emperor or whatever in the history of humanity. We have it now at our fingertips. What are we going to do about it? And most people are going back into the old habits of, oh, I subscribe to this website and this podcast and this video channel, and that's all I need, kind of thing. And that's completely the wrong way to do it. So I try to vary things up. In terms of my practical habits, I'm subscribed to certain YouTube channels, but I try to keep changing that, finding a new source here or something that's interesting there, or trying to go outside my filter bubble and look for something I disagree with there. Same with podcasts. I'm constantly trying to find new podcasts, or I change up the mix here and change it up there, because I don't ever want to become settled on certain sources. I think that's stagnation. That's death. And that's the surest way to get yourself locked into a bubble. So I can't recommend a source. All I can say is the method by which you arrive at information and conclusions is more important than the sources of that information. I mean, it's like, do you prefer to read a newspaper or read a magazine? That doesn't matter in itself. The question is, what information are you getting and how are you using that information?
And do you supply all of those sources? Does it look like you've researched them? That kind of thing. And then just take things into context. And lastly on this point, because of the social media thing, another interesting element that's been happening to the human brain is called hypercategorization. All right, we are instantly categorizing things. 9/11 truther. Flat earther. You know, that kind of thing. We make these knee-jerk reactions, and we put people in these little boxes. I don't think that's a good approach, to a large degree. Unless, of course, you know exactly what you're talking about, in which case, whenever the Prime Minister of New Zealand speaks, I go, argh! And I have these knee-jerk reactions that are 100% based on fact, you know.
But, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, and this is the SJW phenomenon and the alt-right phenomenon and all of this. People get instantly put into boxes because I believe A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z, and you don't believe X. Therefore, you're the other side, you're the enemy, blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, it's this kind of ridiculous categorization to an extent that prohibits actual flow of information. And I know exactly what you mean, and it's getting worse and worse with regards to, again, the hyper specialization that people can do in terms of listening to someone who does agree, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, every single thing that you agree with. And then as soon as they say something you disagree with, you can cast them away and, you know, go on to something else. That's a genuine problem, and it's getting worse in society.
And what they're doing is they're listening for the one thing that they disagree with. They're not listening to all the things that they do agree with. And again, ladies and gentlemen,
or even thinking about how they can use the points that they agree with people that they disagree with to create, so, well, maybe we can work together on this. And even that type of alliance type of thinking, which has been the way humans have interacted with each other for thousands of years, is getting thrown out the window to the point where I can't believe you're even thinking about talking to someone who has that belief.
James Corbett, thecorbettreport.com. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the second hour, of the Vinny Eastwood show. Man, it was a really good little chat with James Corbett, actually. I feel kind of inspired after that one. Anyway, getting away from the inspiration, let's talk about getting frickin' annoyed with stuff that ain't working the way it's supposed to work. Got a couple of articles here, ladies and gentlemen. I'll read out the headlines first so you understand where this particular hour is going to go, and if you want to duck out and go and do something else, you're more than welcome to. But I want to remind people that this is, in fact, a listener-supported broadcast, and we had a couple of new Patreons sign on this month. I think three people given $75 between them, and I was like, whoa, that's really, really lovely. And I was just thinking, you know, I really do want to meet my listeners, talk with them, have some coffees, have a drink at a bar or something like that, because, you know, the problem is, folks, we're lonely. You know, you might be saying to yourself, no, I'm not lonely, I'm fine. But we are, all right? It's not because, you know, we're alone or nobody loves us or anything like that. It's more the fact that we're isolated from each other. We're able to connect on social media, but that's not a real human relationship. We can't feel each other's vibes and things like that through a computer screen. This isn't the way we were supposed to live. You know, there's real connections that we can make with each other. That's why people are supposed to hug all the time, and that's why it releases oxytocin. That's what human contact does, even from as young as babies when we're being held by our mothers against her skin. Our brains start releasing oxytocin, make us feel comfortable and loved. We don't feel comfortable, we don't feel loved, because we're under this constant media assault, and it's not just the mainstream media assault, it's the alternative media assault too. The conspiracy scam. You know, trying to get you trapped in a rabbit hole so that you no longer become a threat to the system, etc. A lot of people commit to a certain ideology. I'm a right winger. I'm a left winger. I'm an anarchist. Well, in fact, anarchy is just committing to yourself. It's not actually really committing to an ideology per se. I mean, oh, well, maybe it is. Maybe I'm just talking out my ass. But we were going through the, I think it was Lauren Smith or Lauren Southern, I forget, something like that. And she was talking about anarcho-capitalism and how there's no such thing, right? It's either capitalism or anarchy. And anarchy is not what people think it means, what the movies have told people to think that it means. Oh, it means chaos, disorder. No, it doesn't. It means no rulers, all right? People operating independently, contacting each other. You know, you ever been to a music concert? You ever been to a market? That's anarchy, all right? It's people voluntarily interacting with each other and exchanging goods, services, ideas, that sort of thing. That's what anarchy actually is. It's not chaos and disorder. It's actually way more orderly than anything else we could really conceive of. The problem is we haven't had it yet, apart from pre-Franco Spain, which with the help of the Catholic Church and mercenaries got destroyed because it was such a huge threat to the overall concept of having a controller, a ruler. So if you wanted to dominate ideology, and your one ideology was dominance, what would be the first target to wipe out, confuse, and destroy? Be people who have the opposite ideology, wouldn't it? They'd be your natural enemies. And I wonder if maybe that's why anarchy hasn't really happened too well of late, is that, hey, there is no way that you're going to just say, hey, I don't know. But anyway, I wanted to, oh man, there's a real problem here because I can't really open up these articles and play any of the videos on them because I've got my recorder going on the other end. And in fact, I'm going to have to get the new recording for the show off of the thing anyway because it already just played for a couple of seconds. So I'm screwed with this recording. So bugger you, annoying stuff. Let's get into the article, shall we, ladies and gentlemen, after that sprawling intro. Vinny. Idiot. Health Select Committee criticised for handling of medicinal cannabis bill. All right, now, the dealio is here, right? You're supposed to be protected when you go in to give submissions to the government, you know. And I prefer to take the Spartan approach.
Submission. Well, that's going to be a bit of a problem.
But when it comes to legal submissions, you know, advice to the select committees and things like that, you're supposed to be protected from the things that you say while you're doing it. All right? But that's not the case, and we'll get into that in a minute. Next article here. PM won't commit to law change if marijuana referendum successful. Okay, so, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you who are unaware that in New Zealand at the moment, we have a, a cannabis sideshow, I'd probably say it is. It's not like the main headlines. It's not like the keeping updated every day. It's just every now and again. But the main score is this. Two things. Number one, they're going to allegedly legalize medical cannabis. Now, what that actually means is that they're going to legalize the major corporate suppliers of medical cannabis who make it overseas, don't grow it here, and charge ridiculous extortionate amounts for it so that only the rich will be able to access it. That's what legalizing medicinal cannabis means when you're in New Zealand. When you speak scumbaggery. I speak scumbaggery. So when people... those of you who are bilingual, you may understand this concept where you've got one brain that speaks in one language and one brain that speaks in another language. I could tell you that I love you, and then my scumbaggery brain would say I'm manipulating you so I can shaft you and take your ideas and your money and end up having control over you. And then, hopefully, if I've taken everything that I want from you, I'll cast you aside. Right? That's what the scumbaggery brain thinks. Versus what somebody says with their other brain and their language, right? And now, when you listen to politicians and you've got a scumbaggery brain as well, that's a whole lot of fun, you know? You just sit there translating this stuff because let's just say people don't get schooled anymore. There used to be this subject in the US school system called civics. All right, civic duty, you know, you ever heard of that phrase? So basically, it teaches you how to keep an eye on the government, right? How to decode the BS that they're saying and what your responsibilities as a citizen are, right? That's the whole idea of the general thing. But of course, when you hear that phrase in scumbaggery brain, you go, they're there to indoctrinate you into thinking that there could never be anything wrong with the state and that you shouldn't rise up against it. You see? You see how that scumbaggery went? Anyway, next article headline, and I will go through these articles and try and decode them a little bit for you. And I'm sounding like David Icke. Oh, by the way, David Icke drinking game. Watch any David Icke thing, right? And take a drink every time he says the words decode or reality. You'll be pissed as fuck. Anyway. Cannabis smokers are far less of a threat to society than drunks. It's coming out of the Daily Post here. So if we've got a little bit of time, ladies and gentlemen, I do want to, you know, thank all my Patreons and all my PayPal donors, all my KiwiBank donors, all the people who click on those advertisements and things like that you see on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com or on my videos, you know, Google Ads and things like that. All of that stuff does help. Also, I want to thank all those people who are giving the super chats as well when I do these YouTube live streams. But in either case, this is the reason why this show continues to survive, ladies and gentlemen, is because just like last week, when Patreon charged all my Patreons, I was able to pay for 1 week's rent and the household power and internet. Just like that. And that's because of you folks. Okay? You literally kept me in house and home and heating and internet and communication just via your Patreon contribution. So for those of you who do want to support me on Patreon that don't already, go to patreon.com/Vinny Eastwood or just the vinnyeastwoodshow.com and click on the little Patreon link there. So first article. I'm all over the place today, ladies and gentlemen. You'll have to forgive me. I'm a little excited. I don't know, maybe being stretched in too many different directions with lots of different responsibilities and lots of different organizations. And indeed, the reason why I'm doing these particular cannabis articles today was after a meeting that I had with the leadership of the Joint Chiefs of the Legalized Cannabis Party here in New Zealand. And these were three articles that actually came up in conversation, which things that people really do need to understand. So I'm remarkably biased on this subject, but that's what happens when your goal is the truth and not protecting people's propaganda or their sensibilities. The administrators of Health Select Committee wrote to some submitters on the medicinal cannabis bill, giving them the option to change their submission, as many had admitted to breaking the law. Right, you go and you have a submission. Hi, I smoked a joint once, and it didn't kill me or do anything bad to me. In fact, I rather enjoy it. That's illegal. You can get done for that. The government's medicinal cannabis bill, which would amend the Drugs Act. Now, those of you who don't understand, in New Zealand, we've got this thing called the Misuse of Drugs Act. Okay, cannabis is in there, and it shouldn't be in there, right? There's plenty of drugs that get misused and things like that, and cannabis is in there. It can't really be misused per se, because misuse implies damage, harm, killing people, that kind of thing. And objectively, if you look at the evidence, the people who are, you know, claim to have damage from cannabis and everything like that are also alcoholics. Or they're also addicted to painkillers. Or they're also, you know, so on and so forth. So meta-analysis has really concluded to a large degree that many of the problems that people claim to be caused by cannabis are in fact caused by other elements that weren't part of those studies initially. Okay, so that's why I like meta-analysis, because you get a whole picture of how everything works. For instance, the rumor that, hey, if you smoke weed, you might get into a car accident and be a dangerous driver, no. Meta-analysis reveals that the main causes of accidents are alcohol, being in a rush, being on pharmaceutical drugs, being a young man, or being angry. Right? What is something that mostly people aren't when they're on cannabis? They're not in a rush. And they're not angry. They don't need pharmaceutical drugs, and they're not drunk because they're stoned, right? The only other kicker there is if you're a young man. You know, young men cause accidents. They haven't got the frontal cortex completely developed yet, so their higher rational thinking skills aren't yet fully developed either. Hence, when I was young, I crashed a car twice, all right? Little fender benders, nothing to get too much of a hizzy over. Have I crashed it since? No. So, there is your story, ladies and gentlemen. And indeed, if you look at the meta-analysis again about driver statistics with the use of cannabis, you find that cannabis users, on average, are 30% less likely to get into an accident than somebody who's sober. All right? You're a third-ish less likely to get into an accident when you're high, rather than being sober. Now, perhaps the comedian Bill Hicks understood this, when he claimed that cannabis should not only be legal, it should be mandatory. Somebody getting angry, tooting at somebody on the freeway, taking life too seriously, he needed to have a joint. The anger goes away. It's a solution to most of life's problems. And the cause of most of life's problems is it's being illegal. Okay, and one of the points I'm trying to make going through these articles here, just in general, is that you don't understand that there's a general trend or a general agenda, more appropriately saying it, because if you understand that there's an agenda to keep cannabis illegal by any means necessary, delay tactics, propaganda, calling into question, X that or the other, straight up lies, or media blitzes and things of that nature. All of these things come in together to accomplish the one goal, which is not to make cannabis illegal, but just to keep it that way, all right? Until such a time as the enormous corporate apparatus by Monsanto and other companies that exist in the United States, so that when they go, hey, we need to legalize cannabis here, suddenly there's a whole bunch of corporations that can supply and get that stuff done, all right? And they can continue to have a monopoly on that, you know, quote-unquote, drug, just like they have a generalized monopoly on the sales of other drugs, nicotine, alcohol, caffeine, etc. Massive corporate conglomerates controlling the overall production. Not all of it, mind you. There'll still be home growers. There'll still be little shop growers, boutiques, and so on and so forth. But they won't account for the vast majority of the sales and the taxation and so on and so forth. They want that under one big corporate umbrella. And when I say umbrella, I don't mean they're all part of the same corporation. I'm talking about they've all got similar shareholders, and they masquerade as being completely different corporations when really they're owned and controlled and operated and benefit the same interests, the globalist interest, all right? Because let's say you're introducing competition, all right? Rockefeller said competition is a sin. These people aren't going to just let their monopolies on oil, which is plastics, which can be made out of hemp. So hence, it's a competition, and hence it needs to be wiped out. Now, they figure they already wiped it out. But, you know, the truth's coming out, allegedly, a lot of people have been saying. But I am always cynical when people say the truth about X, Y, Z is coming out, especially when it comes to cannabis, because the truth about cannabis is so complete counterpoint to what people have been told that their entire life about it, that it's very, very likely that they will simply deny it or get angry at the person trying to say it or try to bargain their way out of it with some kind of BS or get really depressed about it and do nothing. It's very unlikely that somebody will simply accept the truth and be an adult about it. Unlikely. The government's medicinal cannabis bill, which would amend the Drugs Act, aimed to introduce an exception and a statutory defense for terminally ill people to possess and use cannabis. Okay, so that's basically it. Oh, we're legalizing medical cannabis, but only ridiculously prohibitively expensive stuff, and only if you only got 12 months to live, assuming you got that long and can afford that much, right? That's what legalizing in New Zealand looks like. It doesn't make you feel like I've been traumatized by the cannabis laws, so whenever I see any of these delay tactics or anything like that, I get hot under the collar and very, very upset about it, like, emotionally speaking. It's happening right now. It would also provide a regulation-making power to set standards for manufacturing, importing, and supplying. The committee received about 2,000 submissions, and about 300 submitters included information that either admitted to criminal wrongdoing or included sensitive medical information about themselves or someone else. Now, criminal wrongdoing, it's a very, very loaded term, don't you think, considering having a joint or having some spots with some hot knives off the stove is considered criminal, all right? And wrongdoing, it's considered wrongdoing. And I argue that it's not wrongdoing at all. Unless, of course, you're doing it wrong. I mean. Health Select Committee Clerk Ciara Lee said there was a potential for those submissions to have a negative effect on the submitters in the future. And while all submitters are protected by parliamentary privilege and what they said in their submission could not be used as evidence for a police investigation, there was nothing to stop police launching a separate investigation into the person. Okay? Now, the Prime Minister said, essentially, that because there weren't enough cannabis submitters, that it must not be a big enough issue. Okay, cannabis submitters aren't frickin' stupid. They've understood the drug war for a couple of years. Now, the first thing you learn about the drug war, the first thing I learned about the drug war when it came knocking on my door, is that everything they say to you is going to be used to destroy you. If they say, be honest with us, we'll go easy on you, don't say a word. If they say, oh, if you show us where it is, we're going to go easy on you, don't say a word. Okay, everything they do to keep cannabis illegal and everything they do in the enforcement of the current cannabis laws are usually immoral, unethical, and illegal actions in and of themselves. That's the whole length and breadth of the criminality. Cannabis submitters, you know, this is somebody who's actually knows about the cannabis issue and wants to change the law and put themselves on the line in order to get that information out there to a select committee hearing. They know this already. And a lot of them didn't turn up for precisely that reason. They're going to surveil me, aren't they? I'm going to go on a list, aren't I? I'm going to become under investigation, aren't I? They made those calculations in their head, and they didn't turn up. And because they didn't turn up, the Prime Minister goes, oh, not enough people turned up. Oh, we're not going to make it legal, even if you say we want to, New Zealand, you know. you see how that works? Great tactic. Threat, intimidate. And then, ba-boom, the resistance to your agenda of pure scumbaggery wanes just enough so that you can make an excuse not to do the right thing. Okay, that's all they're looking for, ladies and gentlemen. They're looking for you to say the wrong thing, or they're looking for you to not participate so that they can have justification so that they can continue to do the wrong thing. Okay, that's all that law changes in this country are all about. And people don't understand this about New Zealand. Oh, wow, clean, green New Zealand? I thought it was the least corrupt country in the world. No. It's not the least corrupt country in the world. Correction, it's the perceived least corrupt country in the world. Quite different, ladies and gentlemen. You know how they come up with that list? Transparency International sends a voluntary form to governments around the world, and they ask you, so bro, have you guys got any high-level corporate and government corruption going on? And New Zealand goes, why no? We don't. And then just sends the form back blank. Way presto, you are number one least corrupt country in the world. Okay? That's how they get that. You don't know that, of course, and that's why they keep repeating that line over and over again. If you don't know what you don't know, you won't be able to ask the questions or give the facts and details that will discombobulate or corroborate the frickin' arguments that are being used against you. The arguments that you use against yourself, even. And, the fact that they're going to have police, and I'm not saying this is all done on purpose, of course. There are morons in this country. Make no mistake about that. There are idiots. A lot of them have uniforms. A lot of them have government jobs. And essentially, they're coming after you and destroying your life. And in some cases, killing you. And breaking up your family. And destroying the country as a whole, because they literally don't know any better. There are, however, psychopaths who definitely know better, but they definitely don't care. They don't care about you. They don't care about truth. They don't care about facts. What they care about is a feather in the cap, some kind of status symbol that they can use. Oh, here's a bunch of incredibly dangerous drunks that are hitting, killing and raping people. But over here, there's a couple of little stoners having a quiet joint in an alleyway. Which one will I put myself in the line to bust? The ones who are doing illegal substance that are actually probably quite dangerous, and I might get myself hurt. Sure, I might be able to protect somebody else, but I might get hurt. And that's a tough collar. You know, what if they puke up in the car and stuff like that? And then, what do you go? You go to... Oh, mate. Nah. Too much paperwork. But the stoners, on the other hand, young boys under the age of 25, that's what a cop told me that they're looking for. Right when I was writing an essay about it. Groups of young males under the age of 25. So, if you think there's no discrimination, there absolutely is. And it's not just being a young male. It's being a young Maori male, specifically, more than all other races. You're 9 times more likely to go to the jail than any other race for cannabis. All right? That's not an accident, ladies and gentlemen. So, cannabis becoming and staying illegal is a racist endeavor. How do I know that? Because the person who originally started the propaganda campaign in the 1930s, Harry J. Anslinger, was a vicious racist psychopath. And he used public hysteria about Mexicans to get it made illegal. All right? And the same kind of thing gets represented in the United States prison systems as well. It's a new world order, folks. You ain't part of that order. The transparent parliamentary process also required all submissions to remain public, which means they would remain on the parliamentary website and would be available through a web search. This had been an issue in the past when submitters were applying for a job or wanted their submission to be removed, Lee said. So, okay, here we are. The Secretariat thought it was important to reiterate to people that their full submission would be publicly available. And this is somebody who I've been talking on Facebook, and I was just wondering who he was, you know, kind of thing. He seems to be trolling a little bit. But medical marijuana advocate Shane LeBrun says, essentially, the people with the most at stake have their democratic rights severely degraded by the refusal of the select committee to travel. All right, so what you've got here is you've got a whole bunch of people who are actually disabled in some way, shape, or form. Okay, and so if you knew that a huge amount of submitters to your thing will either be too disabled to make it there, or be so sick and incapable of maybe getting an internet conversation going on through Skype or stuff like that, or maybe they're in a rural area and a bad connection, blah, 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 blah. Maybe they just don't know how to do it, because it's actually a lot of the elderly that are now only just learning that things like Skype and YouTube exist. Like, they never heard of them. And so when you say, oh, you can do this via that or the other or blah, 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 no, they have no idea. When the Secretariat wrote to the 300 people, they told them their submission either contained an admission to criminal wrongdoing or sensitive health information about themselves or someone else. They gave them 4 options. Anonymize their submission, remove certain parts of the submission, leave it as it was, or withdraw their submission. The decision to write to people came after consulting internal lawyers and the clerk. Lee said that while some people... excuse me, appreciated the extra information, others felt pressured to not say what they wanted to say. Okay, now, here's the other tactic. What you do is you say, man, that's a really juicy nugget of information that makes me feel something right here. So what I'll do is I'll tell that person that what they're doing is criminal wrongdoing and have them feel threatened as though they're going to be busted tomorrow. And I'll go tell them about that so that hopefully they'll amend their submission and leave out that real emotional part, that stuff that gets through the information kind of firewall that we have all there and cuts straight to your heart. Those stories, you've heard them before, haven't you? They mean something, don't they? They make you change your mind about stuff, don't they? So if you're in charge of the submissions, what is the stuff you want them to cut out and how best to do that? Huh? Oh, you can cut it out yourself. You might have been doing criminal wrongdoing or something like that. You know, this passively threatening. You know, just to get the stuff that they don't want in there out, basically. If you say, I cured my patient of cancer. You know, you mentioned somebody's medical stuff. You know, that would be really bad. And it's going to be on the internet available for searching forever. Maybe you don't want to do that. And you go, oh, you see? The chilling effect, ladies and gentlemen. This is what I am reading with my scumbaggery brain, whilst at the same time English is coming out of my mouth. Is this even English? You even know what the language is anymore when they're using it in the media? Wait. No, I know what it is. It's like, what, 12th grade reading level, 10th grade reading level, or whatever the hell the American equivalent is on that. The point is, it's a 12-year-old's reading level, essentially. Maybe a 10-year-old. All right, they'd be able to read this and technically be able to understand and read the words. That's how much they need to dumb it down in order to keep people from learning words of real substance. Okay, it's called news speak. What you do is you pick out all these really emotional trigger button words, words are really effective at getting across important information to people. Something that's really powerful, that really connotes understanding of an issue, a word like that. And you never use that word, okay? As a result of people never hearing that word, they can't use it. The goal of evil in the media, ladies and gentlemen, is to use such a language so that if you had to describe your enemy, you would not have the words. That's the overall agenda behind dumbing down all this language and stuff like that. When you become older, when you become more developed, when you really start looking into things, your language changes, your use of language changes, and you become a lot more powerful a communicator. They are trying to keep us in an artificial childlike state of communication. Just my opinion. We're definitely not trying to silence people at all. Next line in the article. Yeah, of course you deny it. And what's interesting about that is that you can see the forced denial. Okay? That's when you know that there's something up. Okay? Because when your suspicion comes going on and then they immediately address that suspicion simply with a denial, as opposed to various other explanations and things of that, that's when you know that these people are and lying to you. It was important everybody felt empowered to have their say, but they needed to be aware of how the system works, she says. The system works to prevent the truth from getting out, which is the reason cannabis is still illegal. Ladies and gentlemen, it's because the process by which the country runs, is specifically there to make sure stuff don't change. You've got information that we didn't take into account before? No, we're not going to let you submit that. It's going to be struck off. Or we'll threaten you into removing it. All right. They slow down the legislative process specifically so that anything that the people want to change ain't going to change the way they want it. But anything the globalists and the political contributors want to change, oh, we can pass that under urgency tonight. Yeah, of course, mate. It's freaking written and it's passed. Just like that. Oh, you want to surveil everybody in the country illegally without a warrant? Oh, we can even pass that under urgency. Huh. You want to be able to search people's houses without a warrant for up to 3 days? We need to pass that under urgency. You want to help people who are dying with cancer to heal themselves and grow their own plants and their medicine? Oh, we need a submitting process. We need a referendum that's non-binding. We need to have several more elections. We need to make sure that there's enough consultation about the, you know, and it goes on and on and on. It never stops. The Secretariat has also put in place provisions for people to give their submissions via teleconference so they could have their say without being identified. And as we know in the studio, don't we, Danny, that not all landlines are made of the same stuff. Some people in particular areas, crisp. Other people in other areas, it's like you're talking to Charlie Brown's frickin' teacher over there. You know? And not to mention the technology that they were using for those submissions, I watched a couple of them, was so awful that when people were on from teleconference, you couldn't tell maybe 2/3 of what they were saying because it was on speakerphone as opposed to being plugged into the terminal where the Facebook live stream was being hosted so that you could get a direct line input into your computer where you're watching it on Facebook Live, you know. apparently, with the millions of dollars and stuff like that that the government has at its disposal, full of nerds and geeks and tech to run everything, they couldn't fucking figure that one out. You know? Explain that one to me. Maybe it's part of the bag of tricks to keep people disinterested. I mean, they've got these statutory requirements. Oh, we've got to hear you. We've got to do this. We've got to do that. But everything else is totally there to prevent whatever they're supposed to be doing from happening in the first place. And if they do what they're actually supposed to do, they try to mitigate it or delay it or mischaracterize it or something like that. Okay, that's how this country works. Anybody who's ever been involved with government in any way, shape, or form would understand this dynamic as soon as I've described it to you. Like, oh yeah, that's exactly how it works for you. And I know. And it crushes my soul on a daily basis. Health Select Committee Chair Louisa Wall said the committee was not trying to exclude anyone from having their say about an issue that's of great interest to a lot of people. And I love it how they specifically mention that again, denial. No, we're not doing that at all. Committee not travelling. Medicinal cannabis campaigners have also said they were disappointed many people wouldn't be able to be heard in person. The committee has also decided not to travel to different regions to hear submissions in person, and there will be a full day for oral submissions on April 30. This is a little bit of an older article, ladies and gentlemen, but that would take place in Wellington. Medical Cannabis Awareness Coordinator Shane Lebrun said many of those who wished to speak on their submissions were, quote, severely ill, on benefits, and face an arduous and often painful journey to get to Wellington. So again, the big bag of tricks being pulled out to stop people submitting in the first place so that these people don't actually have to do anything. Yeah. I'm going to skip this article now because we've only got a few minutes left in the broadcast. God damn, I can mumble on for ages without really saying anything of importance. Not on this show, though. PM won't commit to law change if marijuana referendum successful. Okay, so dig this, ladies and gentlemen. In order to get into power, the Green Party said, oh, we want a referendum on cannabis, not a non-binding referendum that you can just say no to. That'll cost millions of dollars to do. Okay? And then the article went, PM won't commit to law change if marijuana referendum successful. If! All right? Every major poll that has ever been done in New Zealand with regards to cannabis has, like, between 70 and 90% of respondents saying, yeah, bro, I've smoked it. He smoked it. They've smoked it. Everybody's freaking smoked it. Are we all supposed to go to jail now? You know? It's like a question that I like to ask crowds, you know? Raise your hand if you know someone that's used cannabis at least once. Everybody raises their hand. And now I say, put your hands down. Now raise your hands if you reckon that all of those people you've known that smoked cannabis at least once should be in jail or should have gone to jail. All of them. Every single one of them. Without exception. One rule for all. Nobody puts their hand up except that one guy who's like, well, maybe you should be in jail, you know, or anything like that. It's just, you're missing the point, mate. Nobody wants to be busted for this. Nobody really wants other people that they know to be busted for this. And if they do, it's not to do with the cannabis. It's to do with the fact that that person's an asshole. Right? That's what's going on here. People know that on a gut and instinctual level. So, again, they've got to pull out all the stops to prevent any legalizations from happening. Now, what did the Prime Minister herself say about medicinal cannabis and legalizing and so on and so forth? She said unconditionally, absolutely yes. I don't even need to think about it. That's what she said. But now, don't care. Don't you understand the scam that's going on here, ladies and gentlemen? It's in your face. The government is debating when to hold the referendum. While it would be cheaper to hold the vote at the next general election in 2020, some politicians did not want the marijuana debate to dominate the election campaign and said it should be held in 2019. You know why they don't want that marijuana debate to dominate the election campaign? Because it dominated the last election campaign and they didn't like what people were saying and how they were voting. Right? And so they don't want it to be this one. But if you do it in 2019 and they all say, nah, and then you go to the next election a year later after everybody's forgotten that you just said, yeah, and then nah, then they'll vote for you again. All right, because you'll be talking about completely different issues. Oh, the housing, oh, the wages, oh, the international trade, and blah, 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 and they'll fucking distract you, and you'll swallow it, won't you, New Zealand? Hook, line, and sinker, won't we? And it makes me feel disgusting to say that, ladies and gentlemen. I feel disgusted that those words came out of my mouth just now. You have any idea what that's like? To live in a country that, in order to describe honestly, makes you feel disgusted with yourself. That's how bad it is. And for me, it's not just about, you know, the bad countries and the facts and the details and stuff. For me, it's about the emotion. It's about the people, right? Because when somebody's suffering, if they can't walk to the kitchen and make a cup of tea without stopping every couple of seconds in agonizing pain... Then, when people say, no, we're not going to make it legal, even if you tell us to, even if we promise we would, it kind of gets you on a gut level. It gets me on a gut level. That's what real people do. They show real emotion. And as Bill Hicks pointed out, the main job of the media is to stop real emotion being reflected back at you because it speaks to you on an instinctual level, and they want to keep you either in a fear consciousness or in an intellectual consciousness so that your social mammalian brain, which makes you love and care about other people and want to protect them and not see them come to harm at the hands of ruthless criminal sociopathic scumbaggery pieces of shit, you know, they want that to not be there, ideally. So disable it completely, which is why so many people are now turning into frickin' narcissists and psychopaths and stuff like that, because abuse and neglect when they're young, and yes, this has happened to me, but fortunately I've retained emotion and caring about other people. I understand not only intellectually, but physically, why that is an important thing, because I can feel that it's important to me to protect others, right? I'm 6'6", right? So if you want help in a situation or something like that, who are the person you go to? You usually go to the tallest person, isn't it? It's a leadership characteristic, because everybody looks up to you. Anyway, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the referendum, which was part of Labour's confidence and supply agreement with the Green Party, was in the, quote, early days of drafting. Now, what they're going to do is they're going to try and come up with a BS question that don't mean nothing, so that when people vote yes on it and they think it means legalising cannabis or whatever, about 50% of people will be confused about what it is and maybe get it right, and the other 50% of people will be confused about it is and will maybe even get it wrong. Right? That's what they try to do. They try to trick you. We haven't even drafted the question yet, so that's all part of the work that we need to do. But of course, we're asking the question of the public because we want to know where New Zealanders' sentiments lie. You already know, first of all, and you don't actually want to know, because you already do. And now you're saying that you want to know, which makes you a liar. Prime Minister, ladies and gentlemen, Freemason Scholarship, look it up. The deal with the Green Party only specified the referendum would be held, not that the law would be changed if the public voted in favour. Oh, we're just going to ask you what you want. We're not actually going to give it to you. I feel like having a heart attack and dying right now, you know. It's just hurts me on an instinctual level. Green Party co-leader James Shaw, former PricewaterhouseCoopers guys, who got us into this Kyoto Protocol agreement, which wound up costing the country $2 billion after they said it would make us $2 billion, and he was one of the people who drafted that piece of propaganda for us, by the way, said the government should listen to the public if it voted to legalise marijuana. And notice he calls it marijuana, not cannabis. All right. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that's a bad thing, and people call it marijuana all the time, but it was originally called marijuana in the initial propaganda campaigns by William Randolph Hearst and Harry J. Anslinger in the 1930s because it sounded Mexican. And people didn't like Mexicans, and so they managed to get it illegal, right? So when you're hearing that word marijuana, 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 it's a derogatory term that they're using it, in fact. Whereas marijuana, Mary, means Mary, Juana means Jane. Mary Jane, right? Now, I don't see a whole bunch of politicians going, you know, I'm really concerned about the legalization of Mary Jane, because Mary Jane is just, you see? As soon as they start to call it what it actually is, cannabis or Mary Jane, it suddenly sounds a lot less threatening. It suddenly doesn't sound like a narcotic anymore. It sounds more like a plant or something that's fun and non-toxic and non-dangerous, doesn't it? Which is surprisingly exactly what it is. I mean, there's a lot of point holding a referendum, but there's not a lot of point in holding a referendum if you don't pay any attention to the result. Yes, it is. There's a very good point in this, and the point is to discourage anybody who wants cannabis legal. Just discourage them. All right? If you don't want cannabis illegal, make sure you discourage everybody who does. Pretty straightforward. It was still in the very early stages of planning what the phraseology would be and what the model would be, he said. New Zealand First leader Winston Peters said his party's view was the vote should be binding but would not indicate which way he would vote. He doesn't want to indicate which way he would vote because he would vote no, and he knows that the majority of New Zealanders would be really pissed off about that, and any of the very small amount of those New Zealanders who'd be pissed off with him about that wouldn't vote for him next term. That's why he won't say, even though he knows. Because he's a liar. You noticing a pattern? Look, this is a serious answer. I wouldn't contaminate a referendum by saying which way I was going to vote. Really. Contaminate the referendum. The PM just said, I won't vote on it, even if it's successful. She's already contaminated it, bud. Okay? It can't get any worse. If you said you won't vote on it as well, then suddenly it becomes really apparent to everybody that there is zero fucking chance of meaningful reform in this area. I have told everybody that since before the outcome of the election was announced, that there won't be any meaningful change on this front. I said that Peter Dunn from United Future Party, who got tossed out in the last election, would have to die, not go out of parliament, but actually be dead in the ground before we would get any movement on this issue. Does this mean that people should go out and kill him? No. I'm just saying that his influence is still around. And until he's passed on, there's a guy who's managed to keep it successfully illegal for like 6 terms of parliament in a row, ladies and gentlemen. That's 3 years a term, right? That one guy. Confidence and supply agreement, no change on the cannabis laws. And as soon as he gets out of parliament and his word doesn't fucking matter, he says, oh, I'm actually in favour of cannabis laws being changed and stuff like that. You see? Bait and switch. BS. It's freaking everywhere, man. I hate it. Cannabis smokers, this is from Daily Post, are far less of a threat to society than drunks. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you must know this for a fact, okay? As the Bill Hicks thing goes, you're at a concert, you're at a ball game, somebody's really violent, aggressive, and obnoxious. Are they drunk or are they smoking pot? They're drunk. I have never seen people on pot get into a fight because it is fucking impossible. Hey, buddy.
Hey, what?
Hey. Hey. End of argument. Okay? that's how it works. Should drugs like cannabis be sold in off licenses? North Wales Police and Crime Commissioner thinks so. Arfon Jones recently came out and called for steps to be taken to control the sale of certain illegal substances. He said, I want to see drugs controlled and sold by responsible retailers similar to off-licenses that sell alcohol. I don't see a difference between the use of alcohol and the use of cannabis. The fact that he can't see a difference, I can understand maybe on one level what he's saying there, but there's a hell of a lot of difference. The outspoken former policeman has also come out publicly in the past saying that the current war on drug crime has totally failed. His views have provoked a strong reaction among readers, with many coming out either for or against the suggestion on social media. Here's just what some of you had to say about it. Tom Lewis wrote on Facebook, "I'm not a weed smoker and never have been, but I completely agree with Arfon on this. Trouble is, people are so close-minded that they refuse to see things from a different perspective. Alcohol is one of the worst drugs there is, yet being intoxicated isn't only socially acceptable, it's become glamorized. Pot smokers are far less of a threat to society than drunks. Just my opinion." Now, it's not actually just his opinion, ladies and gentlemen. It's actually supported by facts. Okay, I think it was the World Health Organization did a, again, meta-analysis, and you know, I know how much I talk about these and how much I love them, but it talked about the social harms. Okay, now, a social harm is different from a physical harm. All right? You drink an alcohol, it does a certain thing to your liver, does a certain thing to your biochemistry, and so on and so forth. Not good for you. It's harmful for you, right? Take that one as just one of the looking points at what were you going for. Okay, so over here, on the other hand, we have the social impact. So you get drunk, you go home, you beat your missus, you smash something or whatever, and you pass out drunk in the bathroom, and you get up the next morning and you go and do it all over again. Okay, so you got a couple of social harms that have been caused by that particular thing. Now, would you do those same social harms if you were perhaps a stoner? You know, you smoke a joint, you go home, you beat your missus, and you pass out in the bathroom. Doesn't happen. All right? And the thing is, when you calculate the social harms, the on-flow effects, things like that, of alcohol and cannabis, cannabis is basically the lowest possible harm that there is, and alcohol is the most harmful by far over all the other things. Even if you're smoking a cigarette, the worst thing that you could possibly do while you're smoking a cigarette is somebody who's a non-smoker will come up to you and go, "Shoot, you got a hell of a cough, man. Smoke all day and don't cough like that. Maybe you were conceived with a weak sperm. Maybe your dad was jacking and your mom sat on it at the last second. Did I overreact?" That's more bit of a Bill Hicks for you. Got it on quotation. God, I listened to that Arizona Bay too much. Chris Rees shared some of his own personal experience relating to the issue. He said, "As a recovered alcoholic, I personally know the damage alcohol does. Because of alcohol abuse, I had polycythemia, sticky blood, chronic pancreatitis, and diabetes. Since medicating with cannabis, all my conditions are gone. No more polycythemia, chronic pancreatitis, or diabetes. I was on 80-plus pills a day last year. Now I don't take any." Why does cannabis work for everything? It's because it's made of these things called cannabinoid molecules, ladies and gentlemen. Imagine for a moment that the cell structure that you have in every single part of your body is actually regulated by a blueprint. Okay, you call that your DNA. It's actually... your blueprint is your endocannabinoid system. So when you're smoking cannabinoids, it supplements your endocannabinoid system and helps to rebuild, repair, and supplement everything in your body. Okay? It's got 200 different chemical arrangements, and they're all made out of hydrogen, carbon, and oxygen, okay? The three building blocks, essentially, that you need to restructure your blood or your bone or anything like that. That's why people who have broken backs, people who have brain cancer, people who have depression even, are very, very much helped by cannabis. Regardless, you know, just whatever you got, it seems to help. Thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to advise you to go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and give us a few dollars, ladies and gentlemen. By the way, the screening of my short film this weekend is on, so if you want to contact me through the VinnieEastwoodShow.com or Facebook, if you're in Avondale, that's just for those listening live, of course, we're going to screen my short film on Saturday at 8 p.m. stream, so hopefully you can come down there and join us. Kiwi Bank, PayPal, and Patreon is how you can support the show, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for doing so, and we'll catch you again sometime.